Hello and welcome to the 15-Minute Book Club with me, your host David Wares, produced by Wilson of Warm Winter Productions and brought to the world via the miracle of valve technology by our man from Yucatan, El Gavster. I've just managed to sneak down to the basement of the Great Winter Library to get some warmth and discuss the topic for this week's chapter, which is the novel I Am Legend by Richard Matheson, which was published in 1954. Matheson was an extremely successful storyteller in his day. He had 9 of his stories adapted into movies, including this one, which has been made into at least 3 movies that I know of, the most recent of which was the 2007 version starring Will Smith as a protagonist, Robert Neville. Other stories Matheson wrote at the time that were adapted into movies include Jewel, which was made into a film, by an unknown director who was called Steven Spielberg. Matheson also wrote about 60 scripts for TV programs such as The Outer Limits. He knew how to tell a story, and dark stories were his milieu. That he really was somebody who explored the dark side of life. And the premise for I Am Legend is straightforward and spelled out in the blurb, which I'm going to read now. Let's have a look at this. Robert Neville is the last living man on Earth, but he is not alone. Every other man, woman and child on the planet has become a vampire, and they are hungry for Neville's blood. By day, he is the hunter, stalking the undead through the ruins of civilization. By night, he barricades himself into his home and prays for the dawn. How long can one man survive like this? And that's pretty much it. That sets the tone. I do enjoy looking at book covers because I think we should judge a book by a cover. Unlike this saying, covers tell us a lot about the content of a book. And the cover of this one is, well, it's kind of black with reddish skull-like faces with sharp fangs and clawed hands reaching out towards the reader. The skulls are painted in red. It's quite scary, threatening, it's unpleasant, and sums up the tone of the book. And the book itself was first published in 1954, as I said. And a bit of context, 1954 was peak America. This was the time that spanned the years between the election of Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1954 and the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. So in that period, it was peak America. America had won World War II. It had stopped the Chinese and Korea. It was experiencing unparalleled wealth and prosperity of a like that had never been experienced anywhere ever. And, I always imagined 1954 as being like a scene from Happy Days, the TV series, with Richie Cunningham driving down to Arnold's Diner in his hot rod, meeting his friends over a burger and a shake. The 50s was the era of the teenager, the birth of rock and roll. And in 1954, records were released by Elvis Presley and Bill Haley and Comets. And a small company called Fender had just released a guitar called the Stratocaster, which went on to change music as well. Electric guitar, and at the movies you could watch White Christmas or Sabrina starring Humphrey Bogart and Audrey Hepburn. And the big movie stars were John Wayne, Gary Cooper and Marilyn Monroe. Men were men, women were gorgeous, and all was well in the Western world. Confidence was high. Everything was possible. This was peak USA. Or if you're somebody who opposes the United States, this was peak Satan. But me, I'm a fan. And into this wonderful world, this wonderful futuristic world, came this novel set in the suburbs of Los Angeles, in which the world is dark, it's malevolent, it's grimy, and there is no future beyond day-to-day survival. In fact, there is no future. I'm just going to read this little bit out from the very beginning of the book, page 3. This is Robert Neville's day-to-day life. Now he reached over and took an ice pick from its wall rack. He punched holes into each clove half, then strung them all together with wire until he had about 25 necklaces. In the beginning, he had hung these necklaces over the windows, but from a distance they had thrown rocks until he'd been forced to cover the broken panes with plywood scraps. Finally, one day, he torn off the plywood and nailed up even rows of planks instead. It had made the house a gloomy sepulchre, but it was better than having rocks coming flying in through his rooms in the shower of splintered glass. And once he had installed the 3 air conditioning units, it wasn't too bad. A man could get used to anything if he had to. When he's finished stringing up the garlic cloves, He went outside and nailed them over the window boarding, taking down the oil stains which had lost most of their potent smell. He had to go through this process twice a week until he found something better. It was his first line of defence. Defence, he often thought, for what? All afternoon he made stakes. He laid them out of thick doweling, bandsawed into 9-inch lengths. These he held up against the whirling emery stone until they were sharp as daggers. It was tiresome, monotonous work, and it filled the air with hot-smelling wood dust that settled in his pores and got into his lungs and made him cough. Yet he never seemed to get ahead. No matter how many stakes he made, they were gone in no time at all. Doweling was getting harder to find too. Eventually, he'd have to lay down rectangular lengths of wood. And wouldn't that be fun, he thought, irritably. It was all very depressing, and it made him resolve to find a better method of disposal. But how could he find it when they never gave him a chance to slow down and think? 4:15. 4:30. It was 4:45. In another hour, they'd be at the house again, the filthy bastards, as soon as light was gone. So, 30 years before David Lynch released Blue Velvet, Matheson published this book that explored the dark heart of suburbia and the monsters that lie just beneath the skin. A world where the protagonist is threatened daily by his neighbours, who have themselves become monsters, and who he murders in return daily. And for both of whom, the protagonists or the monsters, there is no future. His life is a simple repetition of survive, kill, survive, kill. And I'll just read a little bit more from page 15. At sea, as he got a new lathe, loaded onto the station wagon, then searched the store. There were five of them in the basement, hiding in various shadowed places. One of them never found inside a display freezer. When he saw the man lying there in this enamel coffin, he had a laugh. It seemed such a funny place to hide. Later, he thought of what a humorless world it was when he could find amusement in such a thing. After lunch, he went from house to house and used up all his steaks. He had 47 steaks. Time features throughout this novel. The clock is inexorable, but nothing ever changes. During the day, Neville goes out for supplies and he kills vampires. At night, he locks the doors of his warded house. He plays music loud to drown out the voices of the monsters outside, and he drinks himself into oblivion. But time can be treacherous too. As he goes about his daily routine of supplies, logistics, protection, and murder, this happens. I'll just read this because this was shocking to me. He started his motor and pulled away from the parking lot, glancing down at his watch. 3 o'clock. Plenty of time to get back before they came. He eased the gas pedal down and the station wagon pulled ahead faster. It took him about a half hour to relocate the house. The woman was still there in the same position on the sidewalk. Putting on his gloves, Neville lowered the back gate of the station wagon and walked over to the woman. As he walked, he noticed her figure. No, don't start that again, for God's sake. He dragged the woman back to the station wagon and tossed her in. Then he closed the gate, took off his gloves. He held up his watch and looked at it. 3 o'clock, plenty of time to... He jerked up the watch and held it against his ear. His heart suddenly jumping. The watch had stopped. When I first read the novel, I got this point in the book when the watch stopped, and I couldn't read any further. I had to put the book down, and for about 3 months, I just looked at the book and I couldn't get any further. Because it's so threatening, I couldn't deal with the tension. But another strand of the story is habit. And this, I think this is really important. The protagonist, Robert Neville, is habituated to his life in the suburbs, living amongst the monsters. Just as he was habituated to his life in the suburbs as a husband and father, living amongst his neighbours. He's tied by the force of habit to his home, can never quite find the right time or the motivation to escape. At various times, he even acquires a dog and he finds a female companion. In that sense, the story is primeval. It's the building of an entire new family after a catastrophe. And you can find a similar story in lots of novels. For example, in The Outlaw Josie Wales. But unlike in that novel, in I Am Legend, nothing's permanent, nothing's sustained, and there is no development. There is no future because Robert Neville is literally the last human being on Earth. This story is an endless groundhog day of survival. During the day, staking vampires through the heart, and at night, getting drunk and listening to classical music. And gradually, very gradually, Robert Neville becomes unhinged. I'll just read this a little bit because, again, I think this is quite enlightening. At one point, he's sitting in his house and he's getting drunk and he cracks. Fury exploded in him. Enough. His rage pulls his hands ripped out the clothes from the bureau drawer until he closed on the load of pistols. Racing through the dark living room, he knocked up the bar across the door and sent it clattering to the floor. Outside, they howled as they heard him opening the door. "I'm coming out, you bastards," he mind screamed. He jerked open the door and shot the first one in the face. The man went spinning back off the porch and two women came at him, muddy, torn dresses, their white arms spread to enfold him. He watched their bodies jerk as a bullet struck them. He shoved them both aside, began firing his guns into their midst, a wild yell ripping back his bloodless lips. He kept firing the pistols until they were both empty. Then he stood on the porch, clubbing them with insane blows, losing his mind almost completely, when the same ones he'd shot came rushing at him again. And when they tore the guns out of his hands, he used his fists and elbows, and he butted with his head and he kicked them with his big shoes. It wasn't until the flaring pain of having his shoulder slashed open struck him that he realised what he was doing and how hopeless his attempt was. Knocking aside two women, he backed towards the door, a man's arm locked around his neck. He lurched forward, bending at the waist, and toppled the man over his head into the others. He jumped back into the doorway, gripped both sides of the frame, and kicked his legs like pistons, sending the men crashing back into the shrubbery. Then, before they could get at him again, he slammed the door in their faces, locked it, bolted it, and dropped the heavy bar in its slots. Robert Neville stood in the cold blackness of his house, listening to the vampire's scream. He stood against the wall, clubbing slowly and weakly at the plaster, tears streaming down his bearded cheeks, his bleeding hands pulsing with pain. Everything was gone. Everything. "Virginia," he sobbed like a lost, frightened child. "Virginia. Virginia." So Neville, on the one hand, is dealing with survival. On the other hand, he's dealing with the grief of losing his wife and child. And gradually, he goes from being unhinged to becoming a monster. He himself becomes a monster. For example, in his attempts to understand the virus that's turned everyone but him into a vampire, he captures and experiments on a woman. She's actually still alive, though she's a vampire. And when he's finished with her, he throws out her body like trash. At another point, he tries to recall if he staked 11 or 12 children through the heart that morning. He's not quite sure. And he discovers eventually that the vampires are actually terrified of him. He is their monster. He is their troll, their Grendel. He visits them while they're asleep and murders them wholesale. He is their legend. And I'll just read this little quote. About when he realizes actually the tables are turned. They're not monsters fighting him. He's a monster trying to destroy them. He fell against the windows and looked out. The street was filled with people. They milled and stirred in the grey light of morning, the sound of their talking like the buzzing of a million insects. He looked out over the people, his left hand gripping the bars with bloodless fingers, his eyes fever lit. Then someone saw him. For a moment there was an increased babbling of voices, a few startled cries. Then sudden silence, as though a heavy blanket had fallen over their heads. They all stood looking up at him with their white faces. He stared back. And suddenly he thought, I'm the abnormal one now. Normalcy was a majority concept, the standard of many, and not the standard of just one man. Abruptly, that realisation joined with what he saw on their faces. Awe, fear, shrinking horror, and he knew that they were afraid of him. To them, he was some terrible scourge they had never seen, a scourge even worse than a disease they had come to live with. He was an invisible spectre who had left evidence of his existence, the bloodless bodies of their loved ones. And he understood what they felt and did not hate them. His right hand tightened on the tiny envelope of pills. So long as the end did not come with violence, so long as they did not have to be butchered before their eyes. Robert never looked out over the new people of the earth. He knew he did not belong to them. So, in the end, he is the monster. And this book is an excellent read. I've got to say, it's compared to most of the recent movies I've seen about Monsters, this is very much gets to the heart of Darkness, and compare. But it's very much of its own time. If you watch the Will Smith version of the movie, it's very different. It gets some of it, but this is very dark. It gets at the heart of Darkness in contemporary life in suburbia, the monster behind everyone's skin. So the question to ask is quite simply, at what point in fighting that monster do you become a monster? And on that bombshell, we'll see you next week for something completely different. This is David Wares and the 15-Minute Book Club saying, see you next week. Bye.